From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, an historic day on Capitol Hill.
This is a solemn occasion. Nobody comes to Congress to impeach the President of the United States.
This House is so much better than what is transforming today. We believe and know we can do better.
Also today, Attorney General Maura Healey is in the studio to talk about vaping, opioids, the RMV, and more. Plus, choral group Room Full of Teeth on experimenting with what's possible with the human voice.
Just from the color of the voices, it's a color that evokes a world of emotions that we don't have access to the same way with the voice in this more rounded place.
That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and with me in Studio 3 is Attorney General Maura Healey. She's joining us for one of our regular check-ins as the state's chief law enforcement official. Attorney General Healey, welcome to Radio Boston.
Great to be with you.
We have so much to talk about, and I'm looking forward to doing it. I appreciate your forbearance, because I know you know that before we do, there was some serious business on the House floor today, and we need to spend a few minutes addressing it. The House of Representatives passed a resolution this morning setting out rules for the public phase of the impeachment inquiry. Here's Speaker Nancy Pelosi just before that vote.
This is a solemn occasion. Nobody comes to Congress to impeach the President of the United States unless his actions are jeopardizing our honoring our oath of office. Every member should support allowing the American people to hear the facts for themselves. That is really what this vote is about. What it's about, the truth.
Republican House Leader Kevin McCarthy spoke against the motion.
This House is so much better than what is transforming today. We believe and know we can do better. We believed the Speaker when she said about cooperation. We believed her when she said if you trusted them with the majority, they would be different. I guess it's only fitting you take this vote on Halloween.
In the end, the resolution passed with overwhelming support from Democrats and without a single Republican vote in favor.
On this vote, the yeas are 232. The nays are 196. The resolution is adopted without objection.
WBUR legal analyst and retired federal judge Nancy Gertner is also with us in Studio 3, and we want to get just a few minutes of your analysis, Judge Gertner, before we turn to the Attorney General.
Okay.
So welcome. All right, so this vote sets out rules for the public phase of the impeachment inquiry in the House of Representatives. It doesn't constitute a vote on impeachment itself. In lay terms, what happened today? What does this mean?
Well, what they've done is created what I'd like to call sort of a grand jury plus. Grand jury proceedings are usually conducted in secret. One side only has the right to the government are the only ones in the room. They examine and cross-examine witnesses. And then what comes out of that secret proceeding is an indictment and then a trial. Usually the analogy is that the House is the grand jury proceeding and the trial is the Senate. This grand jury proceeding, the House Select Committee, was already more open and balanced than a usual grand jury because the minority members of the House had an opportunity to participate in all of the confidential debriefings. This next stage is even more open and arguably fair because the first thing that's going to happen is the Select Committee is going to issue a public report, which is itself extraordinary and unnecessary, but a public report. And then the majority will call witnesses. The minority will be able to cross-examine. The minority will then be able to call witnesses. And it will be more trial-like, in a sense, than it has to be. Certainly, if the analogy here is the Clinton proceeding, or even the Nixon proceeding, bear in mind there were independent counsels or special counsels in both cases. So the vast majority of the investigation was undercover, was confidential. until it began to surface in public hearings. So this is no different than what has gone on before. In fact, I would argue it's fairer.
All right, so that is interesting because the White House is responding with a series of statements calling the impeachment inquiry process now illegitimate. They're saying it distracts from the issues facing the American people and that Democrats want to, quote, render a verdict without giving the administration a chance to mount a defense. And it says that that is both unfair and unconstitutional. It sounds like you're saying that's not what happens during the House portion of the proceeding.
Right. I mean, unconstitutional is not true, flat out, because the House has a right to make its own rules with respect to the impeachment proceeding, and they have. And in one sense, when you sort of map up these rules against what happened with Clinton or what happened with Nixon, there's really much more transparency, or will be much more transparency. Again, think independent. To some degree, the Mueller report was totally under wraps until there was a public report. And this proceeding will not be under wraps. And there will be clearly a public report before it comes out. There, you know, the devil is in the details. And I suppose that if the president's counsel or the minority members want to, you know, open up the issue of the Hillary Clinton emails as part of this proceeding, the chair would rule them out of order. So the devil is in the details. They will certainly cry foul about some aspect of this. But on its face, this is a fair proceeding.
Okay, so last thing. Here's Massachusetts Congressman Jim McGovern speaking just before today's vote.
This Democratic majority can legislate and also fulfill our constitutional responsibilities to hold this president to account. This resolution before us today is based on precedent. We don't know whether President Trump will be impeached, but the allegations are as serious as it gets.
Because I want to focus on the first half of that statement where he says, hey, we can legislate and do this. This has been a complicated process even so far. Can Congress chew gum and walk at the same time while going through the impeachment inquiry?
Well, arguably, they've done it sequentially. I understand, at least from the media, that 100 bills have been passed in the House. And so perhaps Nancy Pelosi, understanding that there was going to be this proceeding, you know, rushed other legislating through. But they've already done stuff. And the question is, you know, they say they can. Who knows?
So what's the next thing you're looking for from here?
Well, look, as I said, the devil is in the details. So there'll be the continuation of the Select Committee on Intelligence run by Representative Schiff. At that point, there'll be a public report, which will be interesting. And then there'll be a proceeding which will be trial-like, run by the majority, to be sure, in the House Judiciary Committee. So things will be turned over to the Judiciary Committee at that point with Representative Nadler at the helm. But the devil will be in the details. What are the Republicans going to say are relevant to this?
All right. You know? So let it go on record that on Halloween, Judge Gertner said what she's looking for next is the devil. I just want to be clear about that. WBUR legal analyst and retired federal judge Nancy Gertner, thank you so much. I appreciate it. All right, Attorney General Healy, thank you. I appreciate your patience as we gave listeners a quick update on the House proceedings. Welcome again to Radio Boston.
Great to be with you.
I do want to give you a minute to react to what you just heard. Do you have any thoughts or comments you'd want to share?
Well, I mean, look, I think that this is a president who has acted repeatedly as though the law doesn't apply to him. So many times we've seen this administration ignore the facts, ignore laws. And in fact, we've had to run into court probably up to upwards of 50 times. We've had success in court, going to court, stopping him. In fact, 80% of the time, the courts have sided with us and said, yes, he acted completely outside of the law. He acted out of bounds. What he did was unconstitutional, illegal, and ordered the president to undo what he did. So I think we, as a state AG, I mean, we have seen this time and time again. What has been reported in recent weeks is incredibly alarming, I think, and should be concerning for all Americans. And at the end of the day, the impeachment is now a process whereby the American public will get to have an opportunity to have the case laid out. My office does that every day. And to me, it's like any other public process, public trial, where there's an opportunity for the presentation of evidence, the taking of testimony, and ultimately then members of the House will be able to decide. I think importantly now with this vote, the American public will have a better sense as well. I think what you're hearing from Republicans today, what you're hearing from the president in terms of demonizing this, characterizing it as illegitimate, is just classic. That's what classically happens. Whenever, you know, we see that with defendants. You know, you put somebody on trial, you bring a charge, they don't like it. The first thing you try to do is try to delegitimize the process by calling it by certain names, using certain characterizations. We'll see that probably in the airwaves over the next couple of days. I'll remind people, though, when things started to break a few weeks ago and different members, both Democrats and Republicans, came out of those closed sessions, those hearings, they were really, I think many of them, visibly shaken by what they heard. No, so, you know, I, for one, want to see now what it is that they were privy to, what it is that really transpired here. I think this is fundamentally about protecting our democracy. It's certainly provided for in the Constitution, and I think it's necessary for this country to move forward.
All right. So we have a lot of other business we want to get to with you. Next, I want to turn to some of the lawsuits coming from your office, but I want to invite listeners now to join the conversation. You, call us. What questions do you have for the Attorney General? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation, or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. So, Attorney General Healy, I want to start with vaping. State health officials say another person in Massachusetts died from a vaping-related illness. The initial report suggests that the latest fatality came from vaping nicotine products. So do you worry that the statewide vaping ban, because this unfortunate death happened once the ban was in place, is it sufficient? Is it providing enough protection?
Well, the people who now are not able to purchase products here in Massachusetts, we know, have gone over the border. Many of them are buying them in New Hampshire. So that's something that's happening. But look, this is a serious public health issue. I started talking about youth vaping and what I saw as an epidemic well over a year ago. It's when we launched our investigation into Juul. We sued a couple e-cigarette companies. We shut down some online retailers who were selling to kids under the age of 21 illegally in the state. My office is currently now in court defending the governor's ban. This is the 4-month public health emergency ban, and it's an important public health issue. Very concerning. This is the second death now in Massachusetts. We have received other reports of serious pulmonary and respiratory illnesses, and it's important that our state be working with CDC and others who are looking at this, because this is, of course, a nationwide issue, to get to the bottom of what is happening. I'll also share with the listening audience today. Today there was a report, which is really staggering, a report that Juul actually knew that the liquid that is contained in its pods, last March, some batch of it was contaminated. And the CEO himself basically said, we're not going to tell the public, let them continue to, we're going to continue to sell this stuff, and we're not going to tell anybody. And he then proceeded in his email to say terrible things about Juul users. But it just shows, you know, and really raises questions, I think, in further support of the ban right now, because we don't know what's in this product, what's causing some of these illnesses. We've seen it with nicotine. We've seen it with marijuana.
So that,
it's a public health issue.
That's a lawsuit filed by a former Juul executive.
Right.
Based on what you just said, do you think Juul should still be in business?
Well, look, I've been investigating them for a while now, and many of my colleagues around the country have investigated them. Some have already sued Juul. I think Juul has engaged in conduct that, from our investigation, is highly problematic. We believe that, based on our investigation, Juul is a company that came to market specifically with the intent of growing a market share, creating a whole new class of consumers for e-cigarettes, and in particular, you know, through social media and other marketing efforts, really created a market of now young people vaping. I mean, I talk to school nurses and coaches and teachers, parents. I'm around the state, you know, and no matter where I go, people come up to me and talk about the pervasiveness of vaping in our schools, And it's a real serious concern.
Let's talk about the black market dimension. You mentioned the CDC a couple of minutes ago, and they have said that the latest national and state findings suggest that products containing THC, especially those from the street or black market, are linked to most of the cases of vaping-related illness. So there are critics who would argue the vaping ban is actually pushing more people into these unregulated products where the bulk of the problem is. How do you address that criticism?
I think I just did in part by telling what we learned about Juul today. Juul, a product that's out there in the market, not in the black market, but on the market for sale, evidently Juul was using a liquid that was contaminated. And, you know, so Juul's, of course...
According to this lawsuit.
According to the lawsuit.
I'm not sure that that undermines the CDC's data that there are black market concerns as well. You talked about the number of young people who are vaping. Mm-hmm. It's not legal for them to do so. Are we potentially running the risk of pushing people into a further unregulated set of products that they use?
Well, I think that while that may be a concern, it does not mean that we should not take action now to make sure that we are taking steps to protect people here in the state from products that may be on the shelves that may pose a serious health risk. So I think it's okay to do both, to take action now as necessary, and then address, you know, black market concerns as matters move forward. And certainly my office will be prepared to take action against black market actors who are operating outside of a regulatory regime.
1-800-423-8255 is the number if you'd like to ask Attorney General Maura Healey a question, or that's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's take a call. Lisa is on the line from Carlisle. What would you like to know, Lisa?
Yes, it's my understanding that approximately 5% of the beds in Massachusetts for addicts are dual diagnosis. However, most estimates say that at least 70% or more of the opioid addicts are actually dual diagnosis, so they have significant mental health issues. How will we ever solve this crisis if we don't have sufficient beds to treat the underlying mental health issues that go along with the opioid addiction?
Thanks for the call, Lisa. So, Attorney General Healey, how do you think about the dual diagnosis tension and the way the Commonwealth needs to invest in responding to the opioid crisis alongside mental health?
Well, I think from my perspective, and look, my office, I don't think there's an issue that we've spent more time on than this opioid crisis. And, you know, we've come at it from a number of different angles, taken a lot of different approaches, including most recently suing Purdue Pharma and the Sackler family for their role in all of this. But I think what this really is about is a serious need to provide more resources for behavioral health needs. And Lisa's absolutely right. I mean, substance use disorder is a behavioral health issue in and of itself. But oftentimes, you know, you see substance use disorder alongside other mental health issues. And I don't think we can do enough in terms of providing more beds, more treatment, also longer term treatment. And we need to make it a lot easier for families to access the care that they need. I mean, I sat with a group the other day, and, you know, I was in Fall River, and it's a wonderful organization formed by families who have lost loved ones to this crisis or currently have, you know, kids and family members who are either addicted or in recovery. And it was just so clear listening to them, and they had great ideas about what needs to happen. And Lisa is absolutely right. We need more treatment, more beds, more long-term programming, and we need to make it easier for people to navigate and know where to go.
Would you say that the primary response to the opioid crisis from your office has been engaging in the Purdue Pharma lawsuit?
No, I'll just run people through it. I mean, starting in 2015 when I took office, the first thing we did, we went after the maker of Narcan, who was overcharging for Narcan. We got the maker to reduce the price and then enter into an agreement with our office where they made Narcan available to all first responders in the state at a lower cost. We then went down the list one by one of prescribers who were prescribing Oxy and other opioids off the charts and took action against them, some of it civil, some of it criminal. We went after those who were charging cash for Suboxone in violation of mass health laws. We went after some of the pharmacies and entered into agreements with CVS and Walgreens and others to get them to train their pharmacists before they handed out opioids. And to adopt better dispensing practices. We worked with the Mass Medical Society to change some of the rules around the prescribing of opioids. But yes, we also launched investigations into six opioid manufacturers and distributors. So the companies that were making opioids, but also the companies like Cardinal Health and McKesson who were distributing those opioids throughout Massachusetts.
I want to come back to the Purdue Pharma one for a minute. You talked a minute ago about the point, the importance in response to Lisa's call of a more comprehensive approach. You were one of the attorneys general who chose not to accept or participate in the settlement, the bankruptcy settlement that Purdue Pharma achieved. Any concern that by letting that sort of bird in the hand go, you might be foregoing money that would allow the Commonwealth to invest in the very kinds of services you're talking about?
Not at all. And I'll tell you why. I think what they offered was really, I'll just be blunt, a joke. Here's what happened. We sued Purdue and we sued the Sacklers. The Sacklers are the family that owns and controls Purdue, and they have made billions and billions of dollars over the years from the sales of Oxy, taking as much as $11 or $13 billion from the company over the years just through Oxy sales alone. We were the first state to name the Sacklers in addition to naming the company. That resulted in any number of other lawsuits being filed against both Purdue and the Sacklers. Purdue, not surprisingly, facing that exposure files for bankruptcy. The Sacklers then, as one of the wealthiest families in America, then runs into bankruptcy court and has tried to claim protection there.
And you feel like the Sacklers need to pay more than they are? You want more pain from the Sacklers in response to this?
We want a few things. First of all, bankruptcy isn't for billionaires. It never has been, and it shouldn't be. But the way we look at this is really through the lens of the families that we have listened to. Families want justice. They don't want to see what happened in 2007 happen again. In 2007, Purdue paid a big fine, served up a couple of executives to plead guilty, and then agreed not to engage in wrongdoing again. What happened after 2007? They doubled down on their bad sales and marketing practices, continued to prescribe opioids, continued to deliver opioids and Oxy throughout the state here, and that led us to file the lawsuit. Families don't want to see them do what they did before, which was, you know, make sure the story never got out, that the documents weren't produced. This was all done through confidential settlement agreements. So my office is seeking justice in the form of transparency. We want the story told. We want an acknowledgement of wrongdoing. We want all the documents related to this debacle to be made public. We want also, of course, money for treatment. But I'll tell you.
What would be enough?
You're never going to have enough. I'll tell you. You know, first of all, you can't put a price on a life and the devastation that this has caused to so many families and communities. The number of grandparents I meet who are raising grandchildren today. I will tell you that a couple of years ago, the Mass Taxpayers Forum did a survey just in 2017 alone. The crisis cost Massachusetts $15 billion. So that's just one year. The state last year put forward $1 billion to go towards opioid-related treatment. So I am all for money going in the direction, as Lisa, the previous caller, suggested. We need more help with treatment, prevention, education. But what the Sacklers and Purdue were offering to states was pennies on the dollar, and it is not worth sacrificing principle and not obtaining the kind of justice that our families are due in this situation.
Okay, speaking of Lisa, the caller, our lines are full and we need to take a break. So what I want to do is I want to take a quick 60-second break. I want to ask you to stay with us, please, and I want to ask our callers to stay with us. We have Attorney General Maura Healey here. When we come back, we're going to jump straight into some calls and give more of our listeners a chance to talk with you directly. I'm Tisiana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tisiana Deering, and we are still here in Studio 3 with Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey. Attorney General Healey, thanks for staying with us.
Great to be back.
And we're going to turn right to some calls, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. To join our conversation with Attorney General Healey, Mary from Andover, you are on the line. What's your question?
I'm just curious if the Attorney General is going to be looking at the racial and economic aspects of addiction in Massachusetts. you know, we had the crack cocaine epidemic in the 1980s, but that was primarily among poor white and people of color. And now that it's moved, addiction has moved out of that particular group, it's known as a disorder as opposed to, well, you're a crack addict. And I'm just wondering if she's planning on looking into any of that and some of the circumstances that would lead one to find, you know, to get themselves into this situation.
Thanks, Mary. I'll turn it over to the Attorney General.
Yeah, you know, Mary, before I became Attorney General, I was head of the Civil Rights Division and a civil rights lawyer, and I certainly understand and appreciate the concerns you raise about racial inequities. Here's what I think is important, though, Mary. I mean, maybe it didn't happen before, but at least it's happening now, and it needed to. It needed to happen before, but it's happening now, and that's a good thing, which is the recognition of addiction as a disease, you know, as something that we need to treat from a medical perspective. And we need to break the stigma so that people feel comfortable coming forward and asking for help and obtaining the kinds of treatment that they need. You know, I think a few things have happened, Mary. One, my office has worked really hard to ensure that when we, you know, go out and sue pharmaceutical companies, some of that money we are making sure goes right back into grant funds that we distribute to support treatment. We also are very mindful of the work that's needed to happen in our criminal justice system. And I was proud to be an early supporter of criminal justice reform efforts, which resulted in significant legislation last year to address some of the very racial inequities that you raise. So it's something that I talk a lot about with my Race and Equity Council that meets quarterly. And, you know, it's an important issue. But the disease of addiction has known no bounds. You know, it crosses every demographic all across the state. And I think it's absolutely imperative that we do all we can to address behavioral health needs facing those in Massachusetts.
Let's take another call. Sylvester from Woburn is on the line. Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you very much, at all, Attorney General. I admire you doing a great job in Massachusetts.
Well, thanks, Sylvester.
When it comes to mental health issue, especially drug and alcohol, I heard a caller talking about dual diagnosis, in which I specialize in. I'm a military vet, and I've been in this field for the past 15 years. But most of the time, if people want to treat all this stuff together, mental health and drug and alcohol together, instead of attacking one aspect of the sickness, the disease, like if you have mental
Sylvester,
health...
Sylvester, do you have a question for the Attorney General in that?
My question to the Attorney General is that, what can you do more in holding these drug companies, especially those pharmacists and stuff like that are doing black market on the side, accountable instead of going after the big fish?
Thank you, Sylvester. I appreciate it. So I think Sylvester's asking about smaller local players and accountability there.
Yeah, well, I can confirm that we have a company out of Andover, IWP, under investigation. This was a company that distributed opioids, pharmaceuticals around the state. We've taken action against a number of state actors. I think, of course, we need to be able to work across all levels. But I do think Sylvester makes a good point about, you know, you gotta be strategic and you gotta be focused, and you can't handle everything with a broad brush. I do think, Sylvester, there's some new legislation that the governor's proposed that will increase services for primary care, which is important in terms of identifying addiction and mental health issues, and also more resources for behavioral health. So I think that's a good thing. I'll tell you, too, my office spends a lot of time on the front end on prevention, education. I'm in the schools all the time with a number of programs that we support. One program that my office created was a program that we've made available to every public middle school in the state for free. And it's called Project HERE, and it's basically a curricula that is ready to go that teaches kids about health and wellness, substance use disorder, and really how to better take care of themselves, especially when it comes to addressing issues of self-esteem, lack of confidence, anxiety, so many of the things that we see young people because of those things, young people are sometimes more prone to turn to drugs and alcohol. It's also the case that we've got so many young people in our schools who have seen a parent overdose or a sibling overdose. They also need resources. So this program also is about helping them talk about and be able to talk to a trusted adult to get help that they need.
There's so many topics I want to get to. So I am going to shift gears off the opioid crisis because I want to talk about ExxonMobil for a minute. You have been engaged in a lawsuit with ExxonMobil regarding disconnect between their private information about emissions and what they've claimed publicly about their position on emissions. What are you arguing they lied about?
So basically, you know, we have a law here in Massachusetts, a consumer protection law, which says basically if you're a company, you can't lie to customers, you can't make false statements or make misleading statements to customers or investors. And that's what Exxon has done and continues to do to this day. So we filed a lawsuit against Exxon last week following an investigation, an extensive investigation that my office did. And here's basically what it's about. 37 years ago, Exxon scientists predicted that the exact amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere would by 2019 be, in their own words, quote, catastrophic. So they knew their stuff and the burning of fossil fuels was going to have a, quote, catastrophic impact. What they did not do is that they didn't tell their investors about that and they didn't tell their customers about that. So basically they've told...
I want to stop you there, though, and ask you a question because they have argued in response, in part, that they don't have business operations in the Commonwealth and that it's essentially an inappropriate jurisdiction for you to go after them on these questions.
Well, that's ridiculous because there are 300 ExxonMobil stations in the state today. So they'll lose on that. Exxon has been incredibly litigious. And I just want to finish talking about what this case is about, because basically what Exxon lied about is they lied to their own investors about the health of their company. They did not come clean with their investors about what their own models showed about what was going to happen as more focus is on climate and the climate crisis. And, you know, they basically have overvalued their company to investors, not taking into account what the cost of carbon was going to mean to their business.
So
they
also
lied
from them.
They also lied to customers at the pump, because if you go to an ExxonMobil today, you'll see a product called Synergy, which the company claims is a, quote, climate solution, that it's going to actually help deal with a climate crisis. That's complete bunk, because, of course, it's a product that we know is in part contributing to more dangerous emissions that hurt the climate. So what we want from the company is for them to stop engaging in misleading and deceptive practices. Of course, we're seeking civil penalties, money from the company, but this is really about getting the company to come clean with the public, stop lying about what they are and what they've been doing. And, you know, if we're going to solve the climate crisis, we've got to have the market be in a position to be incented in the right direction in terms of the energy sources that are going to yield the greatest good for our planet.
Okay, before we run out of time, I want to talk about the RMV for a minute. You announced your office is investigating the trucking company tied to the fatal New Hampshire crash, led to the death of 7 people. What's the status of that investigation?
Well, our investigation is a criminal investigation. It's ongoing. And we're going to go wherever the evidence takes us. Because it's criminal, I can't say more at this time, but obviously a terrible tragedy and very important that we investigate. The New Hampshire authorities are investigating the deaths because the deaths occurred in the state of New Hampshire. And obviously we've expressed and are having input in terms of what's happening now at the RMV, addressing the obvious problems and failures there.
Okay, in the fallout after that deadly crash, the Boston Globe reported that the 3-person panel that's supposed to oversee the Merit Rating Board, which was the board that would have arguably had purview over the driver who allegedly caused the crash, that 3-person panel hadn't met in years. Your office has a seat on the panel, and I believe you've appointed your insurance and financial services division representative to it. Are you confident in the level of oversight the RMV is now receiving? There's a lot going on there.
Yeah, you know, I am now. Certainly, you know, I think what this showed is that there are real failures in leadership and management at the RMV. The Merit Rating Board the board of the Merit Rating Board is basically a three-person board, as you say, that, you know, frankly didn't meet for many years. In fact, it was my office that was calling for that Merit Rating Board to convene. They finally did meet, and I think that the right steps are being taken, including the vetting of an appropriate executive director to take on new responsibilities.
Will you need to do additional criminal investigations into anyone at the RMV?
I can't speak to that right now.
Okay. And do you think Governor Baker is taking the right steps to fix the mismanagement?
I think getting the RMV righted I think that it is going in the right direction. I think getting more resources there, getting new people in charge there, and making this a priority is a good thing. And, you know, it's unfortunately, there's been such a backlog that it's going to take some time to work through. But I think it's going in the right direction.
All right. Let's take one more call. We have Ennis from Randolph on the line for you. Ennis, go ahead.
Yes. Yeah, hi. Yeah, I'm calling from Randolph, and thank you. I mean, you've been doing a wonderful job. We really appreciate what you've been doing. I'm just curious. I just want to know, what's your next big move? I mean, what are you going to do next?
I'm going to go home, Ennis, and hand out candy in probably an hour and a half. Happy Halloween. What are you going to do?
No, what's your next political mission? I mean, what are you going to do next? I mean, after... You're going to run for president, for senator?
You know what? I'm going to try to run the absolute best attorney general's office that I possibly can. We got a lot of work on a lot of fronts, and I'm really grateful to my team who brings it every day. I encourage folks to call us. You know, we're there to help on consumer issues, insurance issues. I've got a student loan unit. There's
okay,
a whole bunch of stuff.
I
call us
interrupt.
At 617-727-8400.
Ennis, can you spin the ball now?
Yes.
Excellent. Listen. So for listeners, this is Ennis Cantor on the line, though, Boston Celtics player.
Is it?
It is.
Ennis?
Yeah, so I just hope, hopefully next, I mean, I know Elizabeth is probably going to be our next president. So are you going to probably be running for her seat?
We're not going to let you. We're going to take her off the we're going to take her off the spot, Ennis, because we're actually running out of time here. But stay on the line.
Ennis Cantor, our new great Celtics center, the other day. We talked basketball and a whole bunch of things. He's doing a lot of summer basketball camps and cool stuff with young people. So, you know, go Celts.
All right. That's Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And listeners, Radio Boston reached out to the Celtics press team to ask if that really was Ennis Cantor, as the caller told our producers. The Celtics say it was not. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. We're listening to the choral group Room Full of Teeth. They are eight vocalists who experiment with sound and what's possible with the human voice, and have studied techniques from around the world, like Tuvan throat singing, Korean pansuri, and yodeling, like in the song we're hearing, Rinde Eckart's Seska's View. Brad Wells is the founder and artistic director of Room Full of Teeth. He also teaches at Williams College. He says a lot goes into creating a composition like this one.
The singers in the group and I. We meet with singers from other singing traditions. The group is classically trained, and we, for instance, spend a week with a master yodeler, and he gets everybody to gain some degree of facility with yodeling. How does that feel to move the voice in these particular ways? What comes up then? And then composers who are listening in start to write for the group, knowing that some of those sounds start to become accessible.
Yodeling comes from a number of cultures. Lots of people, when they're kids, try it, right? Everybody, because they saw Sound of Music, tried at one point in their lives
right. To
yodel. And yet, these are incredibly difficult vocal techniques. Can any singer learn to do this? Or have you put together a group of eight singers who really are weirdly good at trying these kinds of new and challenging techniques?
I think it's both. I mean, some of them aren't difficult. I mean, when I work with my students at my college, I'll say even my dog actually sometimes when she howls, her voice does a kind of yodel break.
So I'm the only one who can't. Your dog can do it, but I can't.
Hey, come spend some time with us, sweetie. We will get you yodeling. And actually, one of the surprising things about some of these worlds that we swim in, singing wise, the more it might point to a developed skill. It's like you think of your if you're a swimmer and your muscles develop over many, many years in a particular way, you're using your body in that way, and then you try to go and throw a discus. It might be harder for you to go from no experience throwing the discus to being pretty good versus somebody who is not a master swimmer and hasn't developed muscles that might be, and I'm of course making this up. I have no idea what the fact is, but with singing and yodeling, some of our singers who have worked years to smooth out breaks, for instance, have had a harder time entering that. It's just a muscle switch that they have to find. It's coordination.
Listeners who would come to you today, I think, would think of you as cutting edge. And yet you have been around 10, 11 years. You formed the group in 2008. What was the landscape at the time, and what made you want to do this 11 years ago?
I started thinking about a project along these lines back in the 80s and 90s.
So a long time ago.
A long time ago. And one sort of initial seed for my thinking was studying classical voice in college, being interested in new music and new art, finding how the voice is used by composers in the 60s, 70s, early 80s, and there being sort of two streams in the classical art world. One was sort of conventional opera singers, what you would expect to hear on any opera house around the world, or super crazy, crazy weird, where a sneeze or a laugh or a giggle is as legitimate material for the composer as a beautiful singing tone. I thought that was interesting, but I also never found any emotional response to a sneeze or a throat clearing. There's nothing in that material that developed around emotion and heightened communication, which is what singing is. So when I started to hear singers like Meredith Monk, who's this not classically trained composer, she's making music with her voice and with the voices in her group that's much rawer and simpler, and in some ways is more like a group of folk singers who got together but were willing to kind of think more outside the box than categories of folk music or pop music or rock music or jazz. Like, what's possible? What other beautiful worlds can be created? The next big sort of aha was the Bulgarian Women's Choir recordings that were coming out on Nonesuch in the late 80s and 90s. And this bright front kind of belty sound that for most classical voice teachers, they'd say, don't go close to that. Like, you're gonna shred your voice.
Oh, so you hear that sound and you think, we need more of that? We need more people pushing the boundaries vocally or changing what we consider to be what we should be training in?
So it's two things. I mean, one thing, I hear that, and at first I think, oh, danger, danger, don't do that. And then I think, oh, but I'm feeling stuff that I have never felt in classical music, in contemporary classical music. Just from the color of the voices, collective voices there, I'm feeling stuff. It's a color that evokes a world of emotions that we don't have access to the same way with the voice in this more rounded, resonant, deep place.
Let's listen to some other music here. Caroline Shaw, a mezzo-soprano in the group, won the Pulitzer Prize for Partita for Eight Voices, which you performed. Let's hear it. So first, there are a couple of things in there that almost sound vocally impossible, right? There's growling, and there's high, and there's low. The other thing that's remarkable about it is that's eight people, which then makes one wonder, and maybe this is a silly question, is there some magical number about eight? Like, could you do something with eight that was different than four or 12, or was it randomly eight? How much does how many people are performing together matter for the kind of sound you're trying to create?
I don't think number matters at all.
So how did you wind up where you are?
It's all I could afford.
I love practical answers like that. Yeah. So if you were 30, you could do the same thing. And if you were two, you could do the same thing.
Sure.
So I do want to stay with Partita for Eight Voices for a minute. This month you received some pushback on Twitter from someone from an indigenous community. There's a Inuit throat singing technique in that piece. They took issue with your use of the technique and that no Inuits were named as composers or were hired. Your group went on to release a statement saying that you, quote, support the important work of Indigenous resurgence, end quote, and will immediately, quote, find opportunities to amplify and support performing artists, end quote, in Indigenous communities. How are you thinking about doing that?
We are actively reaching out to lots of people we know and people who friends of ours know in Canada and in Inuit communities to figure out where the places are that we can look and develop a relationship and support in all those ways that we stated.
And you've studied a wide variety of techniques from different cultures, different countries. Has receiving this criticism changed how you're thinking about your experimentation and your use of different styles and your learning of different styles? How are you thinking about that now?
It hasn't changed it at all, but I think it's helping clarify what the project is about and also where to be alert for how singing is held in communities. And I think it varies all over the world. We were talking about yodeling before. Yodeling has emerged in so many different singing cultures that it doesn't, you think, well, what's the singing? Is there any culture that has rights to yodeling, if there were any? I mean, we could jokingly say, yeah, Switzerland or, you know, the Alpine communities of Europe. But that makes no sense. It happens in so many different places around the world. But other singing traditions, for a number of reasons, might have a kind of potential or might situate relative to the identity of that culture in such a way that we need to be incredibly respectful and if we're to engage, if we're to, you know, study or converse or even listen to and be affected by, we need to be aware of those forces. One thing that we were talking about, including in the statement for a couple of reasons we didn't, but I still think it's to a degree, it points to forces that can seem like they're at odds. And the statement was basically saying that music is a powerful vehicle for connection, for humans to connect from one to another, or from group to group, or whatever. We all know this is one of the things that singing and music does, but it also has this powerful potential and power and expressiveness as an identity expressor. And those things shouldn't be at odds, but they need to be aware of each other. And sometimes the scales might tip more towards one side, towards somebody really saying, "This is expressing me. Let me do this, or let me do this at least until I tell you it's okay, and I'll let you in and you can share." So I think it's around sensitivity that we're learning. It's around clarifying what the mission is. I don't think it's changing it, but it's refining it.
Teeth is in Boston this week because you're performing Triptych, which centers around the photography and life of Robert Mapplethorpe. Photographs of his are going to appear behind the singers, and excerpts of poetry by artists like Patti Smith will be read. This is one of a really multifaceted performance, poetry, visuals, music. Does this feel like a natural kind of fit for Roomful of Teeth?
Oh, yes. It's a really wonderful world to be in the midst of. It's the kind of thing that we've wanted to move into for a number of years, which is collaborations with other artists and other art forms. Here we have this amazing photography that's so beautifully displayed in coordination with this great music that Bryce Dessner wrote. It's a real treat.
Brad Wells is the founder and artistic director of Roomful of Teeth. He also teaches at Williams College. Roomful of Teeth is part of the multimedia performance and tribute to Robert Mapplethorpe, Triptych, Eyes of One on Another, presented by the celebrity series of Boston and Arts Emerson, which will be performed through Sunday. You can find more information and a list of music heard in this segment on our website at radioboston.org. That's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, Jamie Bologna, and Walter Wuthman. Tim Skog is our technical director with help from Max Liebman today. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi, and I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.